Berkshire Hathaway. To the shareholders of Berkshire Hathaway Inc., our gain in net worth during the WASI billionaire over the last years, that is, since present management took over our per share book value, has grown from a to a, or at a rate of a compounded annually. Charlie Munger, Berkshire's vice chairman and my partner, and I make few predictions. One we will confidently offer, however, is that the future performance of Berkshire won't come close to matching the performance of the A problem is not that what has worked in the past will cease to work in the future. To the contrary, we believe that our formula to purchase at sensible prices of businesses that have good underlying economics and are run by honest and able people is certain to produce reasonable success. We expect, therefore, to keep on doing well. A fat wallet, however, is the enemy of superior investment results. And Berkshire now has a net worth of $1 billion compared to about $1 million when Charlie and I began to manage the company. Though there are as many good businesses as ever, it is useless for us to make purchases that are inconsequential in relation to Berkshire's capital. As Charlie regularly reminds me, if something is not worth doing at all, it's not worth doing well. We now consider a security for purchase only if we believe we can deploy at least $2 million in. Even that minimum, Berkshire's investment universe has shrunk dramatically. Nevertheless, we will stick with the approach that got us here and try not to relax our standards. Ted Williamson. The story of my life explains why my argument is, to be a good hitter, you've got to get a good ball to
yes.
It's the first rule in the book. If I have to bite at stuff that is out of my happy zone, I'm not a hitter. I might only be a hitter. Charlie and I agree and will try to wait for opportunities that are well within our own happy zone. We will continue to ignore political and economic forecasts, which are an expensive distraction for many investors and businessmen. 30 years ago, no one could have foreseen the huge expansion of the Vietnam War, wage and price controls, 2 oil shocks, the resignation of a president, the dissolution of the Soviet Union, a one-day drop in the Delta points, or treasury bill yields fluctuating between and a. But, surprise, none of these blockbuster events made the slightest dent in Ben Graham's investment principles, nor did they render unsound the negotiated purchase as a fine business as it sensible prices. Imagine the cost to us, then, if we had let a fear of unknowns cause us to defer or alter the deployment of capital. Indeed, we have usually made our best purchases when apprehensions about some macro event were at a fear is the foe of the fattest, but the friend of the fundamentalist. A different set of major shocks is sure to occur in the next years. We will neither try to predict these nor to profit from them. If we can identify businesses similar to those we have purchased in the past, external surprises will have little effect on our long-term results. What we promise you along with more modest gains is that during your ownership of Berkshire, you will fare just as Charlie and I. If you suffer, we will suffer. If we prosper, so will.
Yeah.
And we will not break this bond by introducing compensation arrangements that give us a greater participation in the upside than the downside. We further promise you that our personal fortunes will remain overwhelmingly concentrated in Berkshire shares. We will not ask you to invest with us and then put our own money elsewhere. In addition, Berkshire dominates both the investment portfolios of most members of our families and of a great many friends who belong to partnerships that Charlie and I ran in the East. We could not be more motivated to do our
best.
Luckily, we have a good base from which to.
Or,
10 years ago, in night, Berkshire's insurance companies held securities having a value of $1 billion, or about a, per Berkshire share. Leaving aside all income and capital gains from those securities, Berkshire's pre-tax earnings that year were only about $1 million. We had earnings, yes, from our various manufacturing, retailing and service businesses, but they were almost entirely offset by the combination of underwriting losses in our insurance business, corporate overhead, and interest expense. Now we hold securities worth $1 billion or over to per Berkshire share. If you again exclude all income from these securities, our pre-tax earnings in over about $1 million. During the decade, employment has grown from a to a, including 11 people at world headquarters. We achieved our gains through the efforts of a super corps of operating managers who get extraordinary results from some ordinary appearing businesses. J.C. Stendhal described managing a baseball team as getting paid for home runs other fellows hit. That's my formula at Berkshire. Also, the businesses in which we have partial interests are equally important to Berkshire's success. A few statistics will illustrate their significance. Indeed, Coca-Cola sold about a billion ounce servings and earned a little less than a penny on.
Yeah.
A penny's at. Through Berkshire's ownership of Coke, we have an economic interest in a billion of its servings, which produced soft drink earnings for us of nearly $1 million. Similarly, by way of its Gillette stock, Berkshire has a share of the world's razor and blade market measured by revenues, not by units, a proportion according us about $1 million of sales in.
Yeah.
And at Wells Fargo, at $1 billion bank, our ownership translates into $1 billion Berkshire bank that earned about $1 million during.
Yeah.
It's far better to own a significant portion of the Hope Diamond than the of a rhinos stone, and the companies just mentioned easily qualify as rare.
Yeah.
Last of all, we aren't limited to simply a few of this breed, but instead possess a growing collection. Stock prices will continue to fluctuate sometimes sharply, and the economy will have its ups and
downs.
Over time, however, we believe it highly probable that the sort of businesses we own will continue to increase in value at a satisfactory
rate.
Book value and intrinsic value. We regularly report our per share book value, an easily calculable number, though one of limited. Just as regularly, we tell you that what counts is intrinsic value, a number that is impossible to pinpoint, but essential to estimate. For example, indeed, we could state with certitude that Berkshire's per share book value was a. However, that figure considerably overstated the stock's intrinsic value since all of the company's resources were tied up in a sub-profitable textile business. Our textile assets had neither going concern nor liquidation values equal to their carrying values. In fact, then, anyone inquiring into the soundness of Berkshire's balance sheet might well have deserved the answer once offered up by a Hollywood model of dubious reputation. Don't worry, the liabilities are solid. Today, Berkshire's situation has reversed. Many of the businesses we control are worth far more than they're carrying. Those we don't control, such as Coca-Cola or Gillette, are carried at current market values. We continue to give you book value figures, however, because they serve as a rough, albeit significantly understated, tracking measure for Berkshire's intrinsic value. Last year, in fact, the two measures moved in concert. Book value gained a, and that was the approximate gain in intrinsic value.
Also,
we define intrinsic value as the discounted value of the cash that can be taken out of a business during its remaining
pay.
Anyone calculating intrinsic value necessarily comes up with a highly subjective figure that will change both as estimates of future cash flows are revised and as interest rates. Despite its fuzziness, however, intrinsic value is all important and is the only logical way to evaluate the relative attractiveness of investments and businesses. To see how historical input book value and future output intrinsic value can diverge, let's look at another form of investment, a college
education.
Think of the education's cost as its book value. If it is to be accurate, the cost should include the earnings that were foregone by the student because he chose college rather than a. For this exercise, we will ignore the important non-economic benefits of an education and focus strictly on its economic
value.
First, we must estimate the earnings that the graduate will receive over his lifetime and subtract from that figure an estimate of what he would have earned had he left his
education.
That gives us an excess earnings figure, which must then be discounted at an appropriate interest rate back to graduation.
Yeah.
The dollar result equals the intrinsic economic value of the
education.
Some graduates will find that the book value of their education exceeds its intrinsic value, which means that whoever paid for the education didn't get his money's
worth.
In other cases, the intrinsic value of an education will far exceed its book value, a result that proves capital was wisely
deployed.
In all cases, what is clear is that book value is meaningless as an indicator of intrinsic
value.
Now let's get less academic and look at Scott Fetzer, an example from Berkshire's own
experience.
This account will not only illustrate how the relationship of book value and intrinsic value can change, but also will provide an accounting lesson that I know you have been breathlessly awaiting. Naturally, I have chosen here to talk about an acquisition that has turned out to be a huge
winner.
Berkshire purchased Scott Fetzer at the beginning of At the time, the company was a collection of businesses, and today we have exactly the same lineup, no additions and no
disposal.
Scott Fetzer's main operations are World Book, Kirby, and Campbell Household, but many other units are important contributors to earnings as
well.
We paid $1 million for Scott Fetzer, which at the time had $1 million of book
value.
$1 million premium we handed over indicated our belief that the company's intrinsic value was close to double its book
value.
In the table below, we trace the book value of Scott Fetzer, as well as its earnings and dividends, since our
purchase.
Beginning and ending. Year book value, earnings, dividends, book value. And millions. Because it had excess cash when our deal was made, Scott Fetzer was able to pay Berkshire dividends of $1 million, and although it earned only
$1 million.
I should mention that we have not introduced leverage into Scott Fetzer's balance
sheet.
In fact, the company has gone from very modest debt when we purchased it to virtually no debt at all except for debt used by its finance subsidiary. Similarly, we have not sold plants and leased them back, nor sold receivables, nor the Throughout our years of ownership, Scott Fetzer has operated as a conservatively financed and liquid
enterprise.
As you can see, Scott Fetzer's earnings have increased steadily since we bought it, but book value has not grown
commensurately.
Consequently, return on equity, which was exceptional at the time of our purchase, has now become truly
extraordinary.
Just how extraordinary is illustrated by comparing Scott Fetzer's performance to that of the Fortune, a group it would qualify for if it were a standalone
company.
Had Scott Fetzer been on the EO list, the latest available for inspection, the company's return on equity would have ranked. But that is far from the whole.
Sorry.
The top three companies in return on equity were Insulco, Lepp and Diller.
And Tanner,
each of which emerged from bankruptcy in 2008 and none of which achieved meaningful earnings that year except for those they realized when they were accorded debt forgiveness in bankruptcy
proceedings.
Leaving aside such non-operating windfalls, Scott Fetzer's return on equity would have ranked it first on the Fortune, well ahead of number. Indeed. Scott Fetzer's return on equity was double that of the company ranking. You might expect that Scott Fetzer's success could only be explained by a cyclical peak in earnings, a monopolistic position, or
average.
But no such circumstances
apply.
Rather, the company's success comes from the managerial expertise of CEO
Ralph
Skye, of whom I'll tell you more
there.
First, however, the promised accounting lesson. When we paid a $1 million premium over book value for Scott Fetzer, that figure had to be recorded on Berkshire's balance
sheet.
I'll spare you the details of how this worked. These were laid out in an appendix to our annual report and get to the bottom line. After a premium is initially recorded, it must in almost all cases be written off over time through annual charges that are shown as costs in the acquiring company's earnings
statement.
The following table shows, first, the annual charges Berkshire has made to gradually extinguish the Scott Fetzer acquisition premium, and, second, the premium that remains on our
books.
These charges have no effect on cash or the taxes we pay, and are not, in our view, an economic cost, though many accountants would disagree with us. They are merely a way for us to reduce the carrying value of Scott Fetzer on our books so that the figure will eventually match the net worth that Scott
Fetzer
actually employs in its
business.
Beginning purchase premium any purchase charge to purchase. Year premium Berkshire earnings premium.
And millions.
Yeah, I thought Note that by the end of E, the premium was reduced to
million.
When this figure is added to Scott Fetzer's year and book value of $1 million, the total is $1 million, which is the current carrying value of Scott Fetzer on Berkshire's books. That amount is less than half of our carrying value for the company when it was acquired. Yet Scott Fetzer is now earning about twice what it then. Clearly, the intrinsic value of the business has consistently grown, even though we have just as consistently marked down its carrying value through purchase premium charges that reduced Berkshire's earnings and net worth. The difference between Scott Fetzer's intrinsic value and its carrying value on Berkshire's books is now
inertia.
As I mentioned earlier, but am delighted to mention again, credit for this agreeable mismatch goes to Ralph Skay, a focused, smart, and high-grade manager. The reasons for Ralph's success are not complicated. Graham taught me years ago that in investing it is not necessary to do extraordinary things to get extraordinary results. In later life, I have been surprised to find that this statement holds true in business management as well. What a manager must do is handle the basics well and not get diverted. That's precisely Ralph's formula. He establishes the right goals and never forgets what he set out to. On the personal side, Ralph is a joy to work
with.
He is forthright about problems and is self-confident without being self-important. He is also experienced. Though I don't know Ralph's age, I do know that, like many of our managers, he is over. Berkshire, we look to performance, not to the calendar. Charlie and I, at an respectively, now keep George Foreman's picture on our You can make book that our score for a mandatory retirement age will grow stronger every year. Intrinsic value and capital allocation. Understanding intrinsic value is as important for managers as it is for investors. When managers are making capital allocation decisions, including decisions to repurchase shares, it's vital that they act in ways that increase per share intrinsic value and avoid moves that decrease. This principle may seem obvious, but we constantly see it violated. And when mislocations occur, shareholders are hurt. For example, in contemplating business mergers and acquisitions, many managers tend to focus on whether the transaction is immediately dilutive or anti-dilutive to earnings per share or at financial institutions to per share book value. An emphasis of this sort carries great dangers. Going back to our college education example, imagine that a year-old first-year MBA student is considering merging his future economic interests with those of a year-old day labor. The MBA student, a non-earner, would find that a share-for-share merger of his equity interest in himself with that of the day laborer would enhance his near-term earnings in a big way. But what could be sillier for the student than a deal of this kind? In corporate transactions, it's equally silly for the would-be purchaser to focus on current earnings when the prospective acquiree has either different prospects, different amounts of non-operating assets, or a different capital structure. Berkshire, we have rejected many merger and purchase opportunities that would have boosted current and near-term earnings, but that would have reduced per share intrinsic value. Our approach, rather, has been to follow Wayne Gretzky's advice. Go to where the puck is going to be, not to where it is. As a result, our shareholders are now many billions of dollars richer than they would have been if we had used the standard Patrick Chisholm. The sad fact is that most major acquisitions display an egregious imbalance. They are a bonanza for the shareholders of the acquiree. They increase the income and status of the acquirer's management, and they are a honeypot for the investment bankers and other professionals on both sides. But, alas, they usually reduce the wealth of the acquirer's shareholders, often to a substantial extent. That happens because the acquirer typically gives up more intrinsic value than it receives. Is that enough, says John Medlin, the retired head of Wachovia Corp. And you are running a chain letter in reverse. Over time, the skill with which a company's managers allocate capital has an enormous impact on the enterprise's value. Almost by definition, a really good business generates far more money at least after its early years than it can use internally. The company could, of course, distribute the money to shareholders by way of dividends or share repurchases. I often assume asks the strategic planning staff, consultants or investment bankers whether an acquisition or two might make
sense.
That's like asking your interior decorator whether you need a The acquisition problem is often compounded by a biological bias. Many Sioux attain their positions in part because they possess an abundance of animal spirits. If an executive is heavily endowed with these qualities, which, it should be acknowledged, sometimes have their advantages that won't disappear when he reaches them. When such a Sioux is encouraged by his advisors to make deals, he responds much as would a teenage boy who is encouraged by his father to have a normal sex.
Hey, it's not a pushy. Needs.
Some years back, a Sioux friend of mine in jest, it must be said intentionally, described the pathology of many big
deals.
This friend, who ran a property casualty insurer, was explaining to his directors why he wanted to acquire a certain life insurance
company.
After drawing rather unpersuasively through the economics and strategic rationale for the acquisition, he abruptly abandoned the
script.
With an impish look, he simply said, "Aw, fellas, all the other kids have won. At Berkshire, our managers will continue to earn extraordinary returns from what appear to be ordinary
businesses.
As a first step, these managers will look for ways to deploy their earnings advantageously in their
businesses.
What's left, they will send to Charlie Ann. We then will try to use those funds in ways that build per share intrinsic
value.
Our goal will be to acquire either part or all of businesses that we believe we understand, that have good, sustainable underlying economics, and that are run by managers whom we like, admire, and
trust.
Compensation. At Berkshire, we try to be as logical about compensation as about capital
allocation.
For example, we compensate Ralph's key based upon the results of Scott Fetzer rather than those of
Berkshire.
What could make more sense, since he's responsible for one operation, but not the other? A cash bonus or a stock option tied to the fortunes of Berkshire would provide totally capricious rewards to
Ralph.
He could, for example, be hitting home runs at Scott Fetzer while Charlie and I rein up mistakes at
Berkshire,
thereby negating his efforts many times.
What?
Conversely, why should option profits or bonuses be heaped upon
Ralph
if good things are occurring in other parts of Berkshire, but Scott Fetzer is lagging? In setting compensation, we like to hold out the promise of large carrots, but make sure their delivery is tied directly to results in the area that a manager
controls.
When capital invested in an operation is significant, we also both charge managers a high rate for incremental capital they employ and credit them at an equally high rate for capital they
release.
The product of this money is not free approach is definitely visible at Scott.
Answer.
If Ralph can employ incremental funds at good returns, it pays him to do so. His bonus increases when earnings on additional capital exceed a meaningful hurdle.
Charge.
And our bonus calculation is symmetrical. If incremental investment yields substandard returns, the shortfall is costly to Ralph as well as to
Berkshire.
The consequence of this two-way arrangement is that it pays Ralph and pays him well to send to Oma any cash he can't advantageously use in his
business.
It has become fashionable at public companies to describe almost every compensation plan as aligning the interests of management with those of
shareholders.
In our book, alignment means being a partner in both directions, not just on the
side.
Many alignment plans flaunt this basic test, being our full forms of heads I win, tails you lose. A common form of misalignment occurs in the typical stock option arrangement, which does not periodically increase the option price to compensate for the fact that retained earnings are building up the wealth of the
company.
Indeed, the combination of a 10-year option, a low dividend payout, and compound interest can provide lush gains to a manager who has done no more than tread water in his A cynic might even note that when payments to owners are held down, the profit to the option holding manager
increases.
I have yet to see this vital point spelled out in a proxy statement asking shareholders to approve an option.
And
I can't resist mentioning that our compensation arrangement with Ralph Skay was worked out in about 5 minutes, immediately upon our purchase of Scott Fetzer, and without the
help of lawyers or compensation
consultants. This arrangement embodies a few very simple ideas, not the kind of terms favored by consultants who cannot easily send a large bill unless they have established that you have a large problem, and one, of course, that requires an annual review. Our agreement with
Ralph has never been
changed. It made sense to him and to me in
sight,
and it makes sense.
Now,
our compensation arrangements with the managers of all our other units are similarly simple, though the terms of each agreement vary to fit the economic characteristics of the business at issue. The existence, in some cases, of partial ownership of the unit by managers. In all instances, we pursue rationality. Our arrangements that pay off in capricious ways, unrelated to a manager's personal accomplishments, may well be welcomed by certain managers, who after all refuses a free lottery ticket. But such arrangements are wasteful to the company and cause the manager to lose focus on what should be his real areas of concern. Additionally, irrational behavior at the parent may well encourage imitative behavior at subsidiaries. At Berkshire, only Charlie and I have the managerial responsibility for the entire business. Therefore, we are the only parties who should logically be compensated on the basis of what the enterprise does as a whole. Even so, that is not a compensation arrangement we desire. We have carefully designed both the company and our jobs so that we do things we enjoy with people we like. Equally important, we are forced to do very few boring or unpleasant. We are the beneficiaries, as well of the abundant array of material and psychic perks that flow to the heads of corporations. Under such idyllic conditions, we don't expect shareholders to end up loads of compensation for which we have no possible.
Yeah.
Indeed, if we were not paid at all, Charlie and I would be delighted with the cushy jobs we
hold.
At bottom, we subscribe to Ronald Reagan's creed. It's probably true that hard work never killed anyone, but I figure why take the chance? Sources of reported earnings. The table on the next page shows the main sources of Berkshire's reported earnings. In this presentation, purchase premium charges of the type we discussed in our earlier analysis of Scott Fetzer are not assigned to the specific businesses to which they apply, but are instead aggregated and shown separately. This procedure lets you view the earnings of our businesses as they would have been reported had we not purchased
them.
This form of presentation seems to us to be more useful to investors and managers than one utilizing GAAP, which requires purchase premiums to be charged off business by
business.
The total earnings we show in the table are, of course, identical to the GAAP total in our audited financial
statements.
Berkshire's share of net earnings after taxes and for tax earnings minority interests. The submitted operating earnings. Insurance group. Underwriting day. Net investment income. Buffalo News. Side chamber. Finance businesses. Kirby. Nebraska Furniture Mart. Soft Fetzer Manufacturing Group. Seas Candies. Shoe Group. World Book. Purchase price premium charges. Interest expense. Shareholder designated. Contributions. Other. Operating earnings. Sales of securities. Decline in value of loser preferred stock at all. Tax accruals caused by new accounting rules of total earnings all entities. Includes Daxter's earnings only from the date it was acquired. November. Includes interest expense of finance
businesses.
A large amount of information about these businesses is given on pages Sade, where you will also find our segment earnings reported on a GAAP
basis.
In addition, on pages Sade, we have rearranged Berkshire's financial data into four segments on a non-GAAP basis, a presentation that corresponds to the way Charlie and I think about the
Albany.
Our intent is to supply you with the financial information that we would wish you to give us if our positions were
reversed.
Look-through earnings. In past reports, we've discussed look-through earnings, which we believe more accurately portray the earnings of Berkshire than does our GAAP
result.
As we calculate them, look-through earnings consist of the operating earnings reported in the previous section, plus the retained operating earnings of major investees that, under GAAP accounting, are not reflected in our profits, less than allowance for the tax that would be paid by Berkshire if these retained earnings of investees had instead been distributed to The operating earnings of which we speak here exclude capital gains, special accounting items, and major restructuring charges. If our intrinsic value is to grow at our target rate of our look-through earnings over time, must also increase at about that. When I first explained this concept a few years back, I told you that meeting this good goal would require us to generate look-through earnings of about billion by. Because we've since issued about a more shares, that figure has grown to a billion. We are now modestly ahead of schedule in meeting our goal, but to a significant degree, that is because our super cat insurance business has recently delivered earnings far above trend line expectancy and outcome I will discuss in the next section. Giving due weight to that abnormality, we still expect to hit our target, but that, of course, is no sure thing. The following table shows how we calculate look through earnings, though I warn you that the figures are necessarily varied. The Coca-Cola Company. Federal Home Loan Mortgage.
Or
Fiji. Yanako.
Chico.
Or IP. The Gillette Company.
Bank.
Or the Washington Post Company. Wells Fargo Company. Berkshire share of undistributed earnings of major investees. The hypothetical tax on these undistributed investee earnings of reported operating earnings of Berkshire E. Total look-through earnings of Berkshire E. does not include shares allocable to the minority interests of Wesco, calculated on average ownership for the year. Excludes realized capital gains, which have been both recurring and significant. The tax rate used is all, which is the rate Berkshire pays on the dividends it receives. Insurance operations. As we've explained in past reports, what counts in our insurance business is, first, the amount of float we develop, and, second, its cost to. Float is money we hold, but don't. In an insurance operation, float arises because most policies require that premiums be prepaid, and, more importantly, because it usually takes time for an insurer to hear about and resolve loss claims. Typically, the premiums that an insurer takes in do not cover the losses and expenses it must. That leaves it running an underwriting loss, and that loss is the cost of. An insurance business is profitable over time if its cost of float is less than the cost the company would otherwise incur to obtain loans. But the business has a negative value if the cost of its float is higher than market rates for
money.
As the numbers in the following table show, Berkshire's insurance business has been an enormous winner. For the table, we have compiled our float, which we generate in exceptional amounts relative to our premium volume, by adding loss reserves, loss adjustment reserves, funds held under reinsurance assumed and unearned premium reserves, and then subtracting agents' balances, prepaid acquisition costs, prepaid taxes, and deferred charges applicable to assumed reinsurance. Our cost of float is determined by our underwriting loss for profit. In those years when we have had an underwriting profit, such as the last two, our cost of float has been negative, and we have determined our insurance earnings by adding underwriting profit to float income. A year in view. Underwriting approximate on long term. Loss average float cost of funds. Loans. In millions ratio of a T. Sub profit less than zero. Sub profit less than zero. Charlie and I are delighted that our float grew in E, and are even more pleased that it proved to be cost.
Yeah.
But our message this year echoes the one we delivered in 8. Though we have a fine insurance business, it is not as good as it currently was. The reason we must repeat this caution is that our super cat business, which sells policies that insurance and reinsurance companies buy to protect themselves from the effects of Miguel catastrophes, was again highly profitable. Since truly major catastrophes occur infrequently, our super cat business can be expected to show large profits in most years, but occasionally to record a huge loss. In other words, the attractiveness of our super cat business will take many years to measure. Certainly it should be regarded as close to a best. Our only significant losses arose from the California earthquake in January. I will add that we do not expect to suffer major loss from the early earthquake. Super cat policies are small in number, large in size, and non-standardized. Therefore, the underwriting of this business requires far more judgment than, say, the underwriting of auto policies, for which a mass of data is available. Here Berkshire has a major advantage, added Jane, our super cat manager, whose underwriting skills are the finest. His value to us is simply enormous. In addition, Berkshire has a special advantage in the super cat business because of our towering financial strength, which helps us in two ways. First, a prudent insurer will want its protection against true mega catastrophes, such as a billion windstorm loss on Long Island or an earthquake of similar cost in California, to be absolutely certain. But that same insurer knows that the disaster making it dependent on a large super cat recovery is also the disaster that could cause many reinsurers to default. There's not much sense in paying premiums for coverage that will evaporate precisely when it is needed. So the certainty that Berkshire will be both solvent and liquid after a catastrophe of unthinkable proportions is a major competitive advantage for the second benefit of our capital strength is that we can write policies for amounts that no one else can even consider. For example, during a primary insurer wished to buy a short-term policy for $1 million of California earthquake coverage, and we wrote the policy immediately. We know of no one else in the world who would take a $1 million risk, or anything close to it, for their own account. Generally, brokers attempt to place coverage for large amounts by spreading the burden over a number of small policies. But at best, coverage of that sort takes considerable time to arrange. In the meantime, the company desiring reinsurance is left holding a risk it doesn't want, and that may seriously threaten its well-being. At Berkshire, on the other hand, we will quote prices for coverage as great as $1 million on the same day that we are asked to.
Yeah.
No one else in the industry will do that.
Sam,
our writing coverage is in large lumps. We obviously expose Berkshire to lumpy financial results. That's totally acceptable to us. Too often, insurers as well as other businesses follow sub-optimum strategies in order to smooth their reported earnings. By accepting the prospect of volatility, we expect to earn higher long-term returns than we would by pursuing predictability. Given the risks we accept, Ajit and I constantly focus on our worst case, knowing, of course, that it is difficult to judge what this is, since you could conceivably have a Long Island hurricane, a California earthquake, and super cats all in the same.
Yeah.
Additionally, insurance losses could be accompanied by non-insurance troubles. For example, were we to have super cat losses from a large Southern California earthquake, they might well be accompanied by a major drop in the value of our holdings in C's, Wells Fargo and Freddie. All things considered, we believe our worst-case insurance loss from a supercat is now about $1 million after tax, an amount that would slightly exceed Berkshire's annual earnings from other sources. If you are not comfortable with this level of exposure, the time to sell your Berkshire stock is now, not after the inevitable Miguel catastrophe. Our supercat volume will probably be down in prices for garden variety policies have fallen somewhat, and the torrent of capital that was committed to the reinsurance business a few years ago will be inclined to chase premiums, irrespective of their adequacy. Nevertheless, we have strong relations with an important group of clients who will provide us with a substantial amount of business in Berkshire's other insurance operations had excellent results in our home estate operation, led by Rod Eldred, our workers' compensation business, headed by Brad Kinsler, our credit card operation, managed by the Kisser family, National Indemnity's traditional auto and general liability business, led by Don Worster. All of these generated significant underwriting profits accompanied by substantial
total.
We can conclude this section as we did last year. All in all, we have a first-class insurance business. Though its results will be highly volatile, this operation possesses an intrinsic value that exceeds its book value by a large amount larger, in fact, than is the case at any other Berkshire business. Common stock investments. Well, we list our common stock holdings having a value of over
$1 million.
A small portion of these investments belongs to subsidiaries of which Berkshire owns less than a shares company cost market.
Summited.
I have American Express.
Company.
I have Capital City Sack.
Yeah.
Joe the Coca-Cola.
Company.
Yeah. I have Federal Home Loan Mortgage.
Park.
Freddie Mac.
Yeah.
Organico.
Yeah.
I have Jacob.
Park.
Yeah. I have the Gillette Company.
Yeah.
I have Bank Bank Corporation.
Yeah.
You, the Washington Post Company.
Yeah.
You, Wells Fargo Company.
Yeah.
Our investments continue to be few in number and simple in concept. The truly big investment idea can usually be explained in a short
paragraph.
We like a business with enduring competitive advantages that is run by able and owner-oriented
people.
When these attributes exist, and when we can make purchases at sensible prices, it is hard to go wrong the challenge we periodically manage to overcome. Investors should remember that their scorecard is not computed using Olympic diving methods. Degree of difficulty doesn't
count.
If you are right about a business whose value is largely dependent on a single key factor that is both easy to understand and enduring, the payoff is the same as if you had correctly analyzed an investment alternative characterized by many constantly shifting and complex
variables.
We try to price, rather than time,
purchases.
In our view, it is folly to forego buying shares in an outstanding business whose long-term future is predictable because of short-term worries about an economy or stock market that we know to be
unpredictable.
Why scrap an informed decision because of an uninformed guess? We purchased National Indemnity in the
Seasony,
Buffalo News and I, Nebraska Furniture Mart and I, and Scott. That's arena because those are the years they became available and because we thought the prices they carried were
acceptable.
In each case, we pondered what the business was likely to do, not what the Dow, the Fed, or the economy might. If we see this approach as making sense in the purchase of businesses in their entirety, why should we change tack when we are purchasing small pieces of wonderful businesses in the stock market? Before looking at new investments, we consider adding to old
ones.
If a business is attractive enough to buy once, it may well pay to repeat the
process.
We would love to increase our economic interest in Sees or Scott Fetzer, but we haven't found a way to add to it a
holding.
In the stock market, however, an investor frequently gets the chance to increase his economic interest in businesses he knows and
likes.
Last year we went that direction by enlarging our holdings in Coca-Cola and American
Express.
Our history with American Express goes way back and, in fact, fits the pattern of my pulling current investment decisions out of past
associations.
In that, for example, Jayco shares comprised of my personal portfolio and Jayco was also the first stock I sold. I was then as a securities salesman. The sale was a shares to my aunt Alice who, bless her, would have bought anything
I suggested.
25 years later, Berkshire purchased a major stake in Jayco at the time it was threatened with
insolvency.
In another instance, that of the Washington Post, about half of my initial investment funds came from delivering the paper in the Three decades later, Berkshire purchased a large position in the company 2 years after it went
public.
As for Coca-Cola, my first business venture this was in the East was buying a six-pack of Coke for cents and selling each bottle for you.
Sales.
It took only 50 years before I finally got it. The real money was in the
syrup.
Why American Express history includes a couple of episodes in the mid-'80s. Just after the stock was battered by the company's infamous salad oil scandal, we put about all of Buffett partnership capital into the stock, the largest investment the partnership had ever
made.
I should add that this commitment gave us over ownership in MX at the cost of $1 million.
As I write this, we own just under a, which is costacy.
Billion.
Annex earned a million in 80, billion in I. My history with MX as its unit, which today contributes about a third of the earnings of the company, goes back even further. I first purchased stock in its unit when it was growing rapidly and selling at a price earnings ratio of only. There was a lot of low-hanging fruit in those days. I even produced a long report. Do I ever write a short one? On the company that I sold for through an ad in the Wall Street
Journal.
Obviously American Express, and it's recently renamed American. Express Financial Advisors are far different operations today from what they were.
And
nevertheless, I find that a long-term familiarity with the company and its products is often helpful in evaluating.
Mistake danger.
Mistakes occur at the time of decision. We can only make our mistake due reward, however, when the foolishness of the decision become obvious. By this measure, it was a vintage year with keen competition for the gold.
No.
Here, I would like to tell you that the mistakes I will describe originated with
Charlie.
But whenever I try to explain things that way, my nose begins to
oh.
And the nominees are late in E, I sold a million shares of Cap Cities at year end E. The price was a the difference is at million for those of you who wish to avoid the pain of calculating the damage yourself. When we purchased the stock at A, and so I told you that I had previously sold our Cap Cities holdings at A per share during the A, and added that I was at a loss to explain my earlier behavior. Now I've become a repeat offender. Maybe it's time to get a guardian appointed.
Egregious
as it is, the Cap Cities decision earns only a silver
medal.
Top honors go to a mistake I made 5 years ago that fully ripened any RE million purchase of user preferred stock, on which the dividend was suspended in September. In the annual report, I correctly described this deal as an unforced error, meaning that I was neither pushed into the investment nor missiled by anyone when making. Rather, this was a case of sloppy analysis, a lapse that may have been caused by the fact that we were buying a senior security or by
hubris.
Whatever the reason, the mistake was
large.
Before this purchase, I simply failed to focus on the problems that would inevitably beset a carrier whose costs were both high and extremely difficult to
lower.
In earlier years, these life-threatening costs posed few problems. Airlines were then protected from competition by regulation, and carriers could absorb high costs because they could pass them along by way of fares that were also
high.
When the regulation came along, it did not immediately change the picture. The capacity of low-cost carriers was so small that the high-cost lines could, in large part, maintain their existing fare
structures.
During this period, with the longer-term problems largely invisible, but slowly metastasizing, the costs that were non-sustainable became further
embedded.
As the seat capacity of the low-cost operators expanded, their fares began to force the old line, high-cost airlines to cut their The day of reckoning for these airlines could be delayed by infusions of capital such as ours into USAIR, but eventually a fundamental rule of economics prevail. In an unregulated commodity business, a company must lower its costs to competitive levels or face
extinction.
This principle should have been obvious to your chairman, but I missed Seth Schofield, CEO of USAIR, has worked diligently to correct the company's historical cost problems, but to date, has not managed to do. In part, this is because he has had to deal with a moving target, the result of certain major carriers having obtained labor concessions, and other carriers having benefited from fresh start costs that came out of bankruptcy
proceedings.
As Sir Keller, CEO of Southwest Airlines, has said, bankruptcy court for airlines has become a health spat. Additionally, it should be no surprise to anyone that those airline employees who contractually receive above-market salaries will resist any reduction in these as long as their checks continue to
dear.
Despite this difficult situation, USAIR may yet achieve the cost reductions it needs to maintain its viability long. But it is far from sure that will
happen.
Accordingly, we wrote our USAIR investment down to $1 million, a cents on the dollar at year-end. This valuation reflects both a possibility that our preferred will have its value fully or largely restored, and an opposite possibility that the stock will eventually become worthless. Whatever the outcome, We will heed a prime rule of investing. You don't have to make it back the way that you lost. The accounting effects of our user write down are complicated. Under GAAP accounting, insurance companies are required to carry all stocks on their balance sheets at estimated market value. Therefore, at the end of last year's third quarter, we were carrying our user preferred at $1 million, worth of
us.
In other words, our net worth was at that time reflecting a value for user that was far below our $1 million.
Us.
But in the fourth quarter, we concluded that the decline in value was, in accounting terms, other than temporary, and that judgment required us to send the write-down of $1 million through our income statement. The amount will have no other fourth quarter effect. That is, it will not reduce our net worth, because the diminution of value had already been reflected. Charlie and I will not stand for re-election to Usera's board at the upcoming annual meeting. Should Seth wish to consult with us, however, we will be pleased to be of any help that we miscellaneous. Two CEOs who have done great things for Berkshire shareholders retired last year, Dan Burke of Capital Cities Act and Carl Richard of Wells Fargo. Dan and Carl encountered very tough industry conditions in recent years, but their skill as managers allowed the businesses they ran to emerge from these periods with record earnings, added luster, and bright prospects. Additionally, Dan and Carl prepared well for their departure and left their companies in outstanding hands. We owe them our gratitude. Of all eligible shares participated in Berkshire's shareholder designated contributions program. Contributions made through the program were $1 million and charities were recipients. Every year a few shareholders miss participating in the program because they either do not have their shares registered in their own names on the prescribed record date or because they fail to get the designation form back to us within the day period allowed for its return. Since we don't make exceptions when requirements aren't met, we urge that both new shareholders and old read the description of our shareholder designated contributions program that appears on pages 8. To participate in future programs, you must make sure your shares are registered in the name of the actual owner, not in the nominee name of a broker, bank, or depository. Shares not so registered on Audacity, it will be ineligible for the program. We made only one minor acquisition during the small retail shoe chain, but our interest in finding good candidates remains as keen as
ever.
The criteria we employ for purchases or mergers is detailed in the appendix on page. Last spring, we offered to merge with a large family controlled business on terms that included a Berkshire convertible preferred stock. Though we failed to reach an agreement, this episode made me realize that we needed to ask our shareholders to authorize preferred shares in case we wanted in the future to move quickly if a similar acquisition opportunity were to appear. Accordingly, our proxy presents a proposal that you authorize a large amount of preferred stock, which will be issuable on terms set by the board of directors. You can be sure that Charlie and I will not use these shares without being completely satisfied that we are receiving as much in intrinsic value as we are giving. Charlie and I hope you can come to the annual meeting at a new set. Last year, we slightly over in the Orpheum Theater's seating capacity of it, and therefore we will assemble at it on day May 8 at the Holiday Convention Center. The main ballroom at the center can handle, and if need be, we will have audio and video equipment in an adjacent room capable of handling another hippo. Last year we displayed some of Berkshire's products at the meeting, and as a result sold about a pounds of candy, a pairs of shoes, and over of world books and related publications. All these goods will be available again this year. We like to think of the meeting as a spiritual experience. We must remember that even the least secular of religions includes the ritual of the collection. Of course, what you really should be purchasing is a videotape of the orange. Your chairman views this classic nightly, switching to slow motion for the fourth quarter. Our cover caller this year is a salute to Nebraska's football coach, Tom Osborne, and his Cornhuskers, the country's top college team. I urge you to wear Husker red to the annual meeting and promise you that at least of your managerial due will be inappropriate. We recommend that you promptly get hotel reservations for the meeting, as we expect a large crowd. Those of you who like to be downtown about 6 miles from the center may wish to stay at the Radisson Riddick Tower,
a small rooms, but nice hotel were at the much larger Red Lion Hotel a few blocks.
Wait.
In the vicinity of the center are the Holiday Inn rooms, Homewood Suites rooms, and Hampton Inn rooms. Another recommended spot is the Marriott, whose West Omaha location is about 8 yards from, or Shames in a 10-minute drive from the
center.
There will be business at the Marriott that will leave at for the meeting and return after it.
Yeah.
An attachment to our proxy material explains how you can obtain the card you will need for admission to the
meeting.
A good-sized parking area is available at the center, while those who stay at the Holiday Inn, Homewood Suites, and Hampton Inn will be able to walk to the
meeting.
As usual, we will have business to take you to the Nebraska Furniture Mart and Borsheim's after the meeting, and to take you from there to hotels with the airport.
There.
I hope you make a special effort to visit the Nebraska Furniture Mart because it has opened the Mega Mart, a true retailing marvel that sells electronics, appliances, computers, TVs, cameras, and audio.
Equipment.
Sales have been sensational since the opening, and you will be amazed by both the variety of products available and their display on the
floor.
The Mega Mart, at Jason's main store, is on our acre site about 2 miles north of the
center.
The stores are open from
11
to p.m. on Fridays, 11 to p.m. on Saturdays, and noon to p.m. on
Sundays.
When you're there, be sure to say hello to who I thought will be hard at work in our warehouse. She never misses a day at the store, or, for that matter, and Orsham's normally is closed on Sunday, but will be open for shareholders and their guests from noon to p.m. on
Sunday.
This is always a special day, and we will try to have a few surprises. Usually this is the biggest sales day of the year, so for more reasons than one, Charlie, and I hope to see you
there.
On Saturday evening, April, there will be a baseball game at Rosenblatt Stadium between the Omaha Royals and the Buffalo
Bisons.
The Buffalo team is owned by my friends, Mindy and Bob Richter, and I'm hoping they will
happen.
If so, I will try to induce Bob into a one-pitch duel on the
mound.
Opposite capitalist Randy Johnson, young, strong, and athletic, and not the sort of fellow you want to face early in the
season.
So I will need plenty of vocal
support.
The proxy statement will include information about obtaining tickets to the
end.
About the shareholders attended the event last
year.
Opening the game that night, I had my stuff and threw a strike that the scoreboard reported at 8 miles per hour. What many fans missed was that I shook off the catcher's call for my fastball and instead delivered my change. This year it will be all
suck.
Warren E. Buffett. March, a chairman of the board.